This is the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 29th, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and this week we're going to look at a few developments that occurred during this week here as we close out the month of April and get ready to head into May. So first, we're going to talk about the final regulations that were issued on the credit transfer provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act, what came out of there, and some of the issues that weren't changed. They appear to be very, very similar to the original proposed regulation that came out last year, as I recall, in this area. We also have a tax court case to look at this week, where the tax court looks at whether, when a supervisor approves a proposed assessment of a penalty on an exam, does the law require the supervisor to have a certain minimum level of, let's say, time devoted or knowledge of the case in question before granting the approval, or does the law merely just require approval, period? We'll talk about that issue and why it came into being in the case in question. There were rather unique circumstances, and then also what the court said about the law underlying this. And finally, we'll talk about the IRS announcing the end of their direct file pilot. It was a short-term pilot that involved 12 states that was meant to test a limited situation in which taxpayers could file their returns for free via the IRS. We'll talk about, you know, what the IRS said about the program, how they feel it worked, and what they're proposing about moving forward on the program. But let's begin with the final regulations under the Inflation Reduction Act's transfer of energy credits. Now, this particular rule that's buried in the Inflation Reduction Act involved the ability to transfer certain credits from the taxpayer that would earn the tax credit to some other taxpayer. We've seen this at the state level quite a bit, where we have basically sales of credits. That, you know, and a lot of the movie credits have worked that way. Let's say, especially if you're in a state that doesn't have a very high tax rate, you know, and or, you know, the group that filmed the movie is not going to have a whole lot of income that gets assigned to the state they filmed in. Well, you know, they may have a very difficult time having enough income in the state in order to justify, you know, the credit. The credit doesn't help them without tax liability. And the states are somewhat leery about making these credits refundable, because sometimes refundable credits go off the rails, shall we say, and the state ends up with a big problem and writing a lot of checks. And it always looks bad in the state legislature side to be writing checks, because it doesn't take long for taxpayers to start thinking that, wait, this isn't a tax credit, this is simply a payout program. And so, you know, when you're writing checks, it looks like a payout program, because frankly, it is. At that point. So they went down the, well, you could sell or transfer the credit route, which would allow those who have a significant tax liability in the state in question to essentially acquire the credits, right? Even though they had nothing to do with filming the movie, they could acquire the credits. Well, the same concept is at work here with energy credits. The idea being that a business might not have, let's say, a lot of income. It could be in a startup or early phase, but it could be investing in this to build its infrastructure, to do other things involved with this, or just be in an area of energy production that's just not hugely profitable yet. But they're going to use this subsidy to get started. But without taxes, they can't use the sub. They can't really use the subsidy. It doesn't help. So they could turn around and sell at a discount, because nobody's going to buy these face value. But at a discount, they could sell or otherwise transfer these credits to a third party. And that's the idea of these regulations. Now, obviously, the problem there is making sure that we don't have six different taxpayers all attempting to claim the same credit, because the person that got the that basically incurred the cost and would earn the credit effectively sold it to six people. So you have to coordinate to keep those things from happening. So this option, as said, was added by the Act to, you know, get them a benefit there. The IRS, not surprisingly, given the ability that this could be misused, is very, very concerned about limiting potential abuse of this, right? Again, they don't want to have all these reports about the same credit being sold and used five times and the IRS failed to notice the problem, or other methods that could be used to, you know, accomplish goals that this program didn't mean to accomplish, do something other than help those sort of startups that have no income, and not help them more than they're supposed to have been helped under the law by allowing them to transfer this credit like six times. You know, so getting a six-time payout, even at a discount, is probably going to be better than actually using a credit. So I'll avoid that. Now, a Tax Note Today article by Mary Catherine Brown that came out on, that is officially to be published April 29th. You might wonder about that, but again, like a lot of publications, you know, they actually release the details prior to the date of publication. In this case, the 29th being Monday, this article really appeared on the post that appeared Saturday morning, that is Monday's post, discuss some of the things that the industries and those that were pushing for changes did not get. First, the IRS turned down a request that many had to allow the separate sale of base and bonus credits. In essence, to divide up credit programs into pieces and sell the parts so we could sell different parts. Nope. Final regulations pretty much require you to sell the credit, right? You've got to sell the credit and take care of that. You can't divide it into separate parts that could be sold or not sold. So that was a concern. Obviously, the concern appears to be primarily driven by the potential for abuse when you have all of these parts. The more parts there are moving, the tougher it is to keep track of. There's a little question about that. So the IRS doesn't want more of these oddball, you know, pieces that could be sold that conceivably could be abused or misunderstood. So that's one of those things there. They also declined to allow an advance payment of cash before the year the tax credit will be earned. So basically, the idea is you couldn't front the money. Now, I understand why the industry would like to do this and why certain taxpayers like to do it, because that upfront money, you know, hate to say it, but contractors and other parties do like to be paid. And they're not necessarily going to wait to be paid until you find a buyer for your credit, and until, you know, we actually get construction running or get other pieces going, they'd like to know that you're able to do this up front. So the concept would have been that, oh, you know, you're going to be doing this brand new credit routine. Well, you know, what we're going to do is we agree to front you the money and you agree that you're going to complete this thing, get it done next year. Now, I see a lot of ways that could go wrong. I see a lot of things happening where people pay for a credit and they go ahead and try to claim it, but in fact, the other taxpayer never had it to transfer. There's lots of potential issues that could go oddly strange there and cause problems. So I understand that, but I also understand why they would like to have the cash up front. Why I'd like to have the cash maybe before the, you know, before we finally get to the year where they complete the project and would be able to claim the tax credit. You know, we need it for, you know, because some of these credits would involve projects that would go over multiple tax years. So bad news is that the IRS is not planning to do that. The real concern, as always, was basically abuse and fraud. Now, if this transfer of credit rule applies to you, I don't want to go through them in detail here, but if it applies to you or it seems interesting organization, they're incurring some of the tax credit, and there's only specific of the energy credits and the Inflation Reduction Act that qualify for this. And, you know, there are two different programs. There's a second program that provides essentially effectively direct payment to not-for-profits, or they treat it as an income tax payment that was made. And obviously, if a not-for-profit owes no taxes, which most often it won't, that would be then a full refund that would come back. That program there covers certain credits. This one covers a somewhat different set, and more importantly, it does not cover the electric vehicle credit. In this one, so that's kind of the odd one in the mix that can't qualify. So the commercial vehicle credit doesn't work here. This one, though, is the sale, and it's generally for those who are, in essence, not eligible for the direct payment program, aren't not-for-profits or the list of specific organizations that are allowed to get the direct payment. And these will apply for tax years ending on or after April 30th, 2024. So basically, you know, ending essentially, you know, it had, you know, normal world means that your year had to end by March 31st, or you had to somehow have a short year in the year you get this, which, and so it ended middle of April somehow, but nah, it's probably not likely. although they do allow taxpayers can apply provisions to earlier periods. So it's kind of a safe harbor for earlier periods and required when we get to tax years ending basically this month in April and afterwards, right? So that'll be part of that structure. As I said, you want to go ahead and look at these. The regulations go on for a while. You want to get into the details because there's a lot of specific credits, a lot of specific details. But if you do have a client that's interested in this, you know, we now do have the final rules and the final issues. And if you have been operating on doing it, you want to make sure that if that deal wasn't done, you know, tax year is going to end after April 30, which probably is true, on or after April 30, then, you know, you're not doing it for a prior year now, one that's already ended. You want to go back and make sure that your assumptions about what'll work on the transfer programs agree with the regulations. At least that's it, because otherwise your problem is challenging the regs in court, which is an uphill battle, to say the least, in getting that done. Next up, we're going to go to a tax court case, the Estate of Glassman Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2024-51, and this one came down on April the 24th. Now, this case deals with Internal Revenue Code Section 6751B1, and this has become a section of great interest. There's been case law the past couple of years where it's become clear that the IRS must, you know, in essence, under this provision, obtain supervisory approval. So the agent has to get supervisory approval before proposing and communicating to the taxpayer the fact that the agency is planning to impose a penalty of some sort on the taxpayer. Now, again, there's been some back and forth about which penalties this applies to, what situations, but the tax court did get slapped down a couple of years ago by saying that this approval cannot be done retroactively, right? They have to get approval before the penalty is proposed, right? The law says specifically, no penalty under this title shall be assessed unless the initial determination of such assessment, that word initial became crucial in this law, is personally approved in writing by the immediate supervisor of the individual making such determination or such higher level official as the secretary may designate. So what essentially has happened is the tax court initially said that, oh, no problem. You just need to get it done, you know, in time. Somebody's got to go back and approve whatever was initially suggested. And, you know, courts of appeal have knocked that down and said, no, this clearly requires you, the way they've read the law, to get the approval prior to the determination, right? That initial determination. So basically, prior to proposing the penalty to the taxpayer, that is where the agent indicates that they plan to assess this penalty when they issue the final notice of deficiency, you know, they have to get supervisory approval. And so that sets this up. And what this case is going to look at is how much effort must be expended by the supervisor in approving the penalty. So that's the case. And this case is very unique. And why, you know, the taxpayer said, well, this is crazy. You know, you had somebody who's technically their supervisor at the time of the initial proposal, or at the time the agent went up. The agent requested the approval, but wasn't really involved in the exam. Neither really for most of the time before the approval, and frankly, within a couple of days after the approval, ceased to be involved at all. So let's talk about what happened in this case. Now, in this case, the penalty in question was approved by the agent's acting group manager. So when the agent decided to, you know, propose, said, okay, I've got it, I'm ready, I'm going to propose the penalty, it's time to go for approval, there was an acting group manager in place. So rather than the normal supervisor of the agent, we had this acting group manager in place. That's going to be key in this case, right? The regular group manager was on a scheduled 2-week leave when the request was submitted. And in fact, she was most of the way through that 2-week leave by the time the request for approval was submitted. So effectively, you know, we're sitting here. So, you know, person went on vacation. Obviously, when you go on vacation as a supervisor, you know, you don't, that doesn't just mean that all of those people you supervise get to go on vacation at the same time. You know, they assigned somebody as an acting group manager to effectively supervise and fill in for her role while she was on her 2-week leave, right? Okay, so fine, normal sort of thing. So let's talk about this case. What's going on then? So the agent submitted a proposed penalty, and this penalty clearly required advance approval, right? Advance approval for doing that. So basically, the agent hit the point to get the approval, submitted the approval request up 2 days before the regular group manager came back. The acting group manager approved the penalty. So essentially, it was approved. Now, everybody agrees that this agent's immediate supervisor on that date was this acting group manager. So that's not the question. We're not saying that acting doesn't count. We're saying acting's fine, but they said in this case, we're not so sure, especially the short-term nature of it and the fact that the regular group manager, the actual form 4549A proposing the penalty and a subsequent corrected one was sent out effectively, you know, a couple of months after this initial approval process. Now, that itself is not a problem, except, of course, that 4549A and the corrected notice both were issued by the group manager who had returned from her 2 weeks leave, right? So she did it, she kicked it out, and that was the first formal communication that the IRS planned to assess the penalty that went to the taxpayer. So the taxpayers are a little concerned about this, saying, wait, he was involved supervising this exam for the vast majority of the time this estate exam moved forward. You know, we get to this 2-week window, and the agent happened to get to the point there where the penalties were going to be assessed. And at that point, the acting group manager, who had very little interaction on this, right, in essence, issued the approval. And so the taxpayer's theory is, well, you know, there is no way that the acting group manager had the knowledge and background to really have competently issued this approval, right? So, you know, this approval should be disregarded. You know, in essence, that this is kind of stating backdoor that really they should have waited the 2 days had the regular group manager who'd been involved in the exam since day one been the party to approve this. And therefore, that person should be, you know, if that's really involved and using this guy, nah, unless you can show he got deeply involved, which appears there's no way he would have in that short time frame, been involved enough to truly understand the case, that, well, his approval shouldn't count under the law. However, the tax court disagrees. They said, no, we are applying the law as written. Section 6751B1 does not inquire into the time or effort the examiner and the supervisor devote to their respective tasks. So we may get a penalty approved that is going to fall apart in court because it really isn't backed up well. But that's not what, you know, the law doesn't say it's got to be, you know, a good penalty. There are other mechanisms to deal with a bad assessment, right? It just said you have to get another party to approve, and it's got to be your immediate supervisor or another party appointed by the secretary. And the tax court goes on and states, we reiterate that the signature of a group manager on a penalty approval form or the signature of the acting group manager is here, is sufficient without more to satisfy the statutory requirements. This is getting back to the whole issue of, in essence, unambiguous law, right? What does the law say? And of course, the court's theory is that if Congress wanted a supervisor to go through certain minimum steps, that they would have spelled that out. All Congress said in the section was you had to have approval, right? And never said, you know, does that approval involve, you know, the agent taking 40 hours to go through everything at this point and review the case in detail? Or does that simply mean, and this is what the court's saying, it means what it says. They have to approve it. You know, they don't have, you know, basically they might say, I'm not going to give my approval. So then the penalty can't go forward. But it does say that the point of this, arguably, and I think this is going to be the tax court's view, was to ensure that agents, you know, did have to seek another party before proposing a penalty out of the blue. And at this point, there is no requirement. Now, the court also notes that they've ruled on this before, not on quite as odd a set of circumstances where, you know, you can argue, well, why didn't they wait 2 days and, you know, just have the standard group manager approve it, that she probably, you know, would have been able to very quickly decide if the penalty made sense. And in context, you would have had a lot more information. But again, the law didn't require that. And so whether it's a good approval or bad approval in terms of, you know, did the manager really, you know, the manager approve a penalty that the courts aren't going to sustain? Well, that's tried by the courts. So in any event, yeah, interesting issue. And obviously the IRS is getting a bit better at 6751B1 and making sure that the approvals are in place. Now they get caught. A couple of cases recently where it appears they have tried to backdate approvals. A hint, in taxes, backdating is bad. And I always get surprised when I see CPAs like in open, like in class or in an open online forum that, you know, wonder, well, what, you know, can't we just backdate this? It's like, no, sorry, guys. Yeah, backdating gets you in trouble and it gets the IRS in trouble, right? No, when something needs to be done or some document has to exist by a certain date, it needs to exist by that date, and backdating can turn out really badly. So let's just say that's not a good move. Finally, the IRS this week in news release 2024-122 issued on April 26th noted that they have ended the direct file pilot this year, where taxpayers could file for free with the IRS if they met certain criteria and lived in 12 states, one of 12 states that were participating in the program. And now they're in the evaluation phase of looking at the program going forward. The title of this news release is Direct File Pilot Officially Closes After More Than 140,000 Taxpayers Successfully Use Direct E-Filing System in 12 States, including integration with 4 state tax systems. Okay. Now, if you didn't remember, there was a lot of back and forth and after some controversy over some of the things that certain participants in the IRS's free e-file program, certain commercial participants had been using, including allegations of steering people away from the free programs, that Congress had essentially told the IRS to set up a pilot program, you know, get the parts going for directly filing returns with the IRS, you know, not using a third party such as TurboTax or, you know, H&R Block, et cetera, their online filing programs, but rather just doing it, you know, the service accepting it directly. And so the IRS at the IRS announced that for the 2023 tax year, right, filing 23 calendar year returns, so the 24 season, as the IRS would refer to it for tax season, that the IRS was going to allow taxpayers in 12 states that had agreed to participate in the project, or 12 states in the project, to electronically file their federal returns if they met certain criteria. Now, in 8 of those 12 states, there was a minor problem. Well, if the state had an income tax, that was not included in a free direct file pilot. And that would be kind of a significant negative, shall we say. But there were 4 states, including the state I live in, Arizona, that the Department of Revenue, or equivalent, whatever they call it in that state, agreed to basically participate in a test program that would allow, you know, taxpayers that qualify for direct e-file and who didn't have some problematic issue. For instance, one problem would almost certainly be if you qualified for the federal program, but, you know, you essentially moved during the year, so you are filing part year state returns, that would normally kick you out. But the otherwise, you could file that return. So they had overall 140,803 taxpayers participate in the pilot program that was run for this tax season. So 140,000 taxpayers qualified. Now, again, that's not a huge number compared to the number of returns that are filed. Let's be very clear about that. And the IRS even describes that in the news release, noting that this was intentionally a small test program. The idea was not to, you know, roll it out and have everybody in the country filing for free the first year or qualifying for the program the first year. It was rather just to test and see what would happen with this program. So it was kind of like these 140,000 taxpayers were effectively beta testers of sorts for the system. Now, the availability did not actually get started until mid-March, so this also probably limited the use of the system. Because a lot of the taxpayers that would qualify with the income limits, etc., are people expecting refunds, and they don't tend to like to wait until mid-March to start filing their returns, right? They want their refund as soon as possible, and obviously this wouldn't get them their refund as because they had to wait until the program started. So that also limited the use of the program. And as well, you know, and it only ran through the regular tax season. Now, the General Services Administration did survey those who participated in this, and those who responded to the survey, which, again, a lot of people aren't going to respond, they ranked their experience with direct file as excellent or above average. So generally, those who participate, at least as far as we can tell, we're satisfied with the program. And that's likely true because one other thing that's generally true about these surveys is if you really had a bad experience, you tend to be motivated to want to tell somebody, right? And so you'll take the survey and say, this was the worst thing I ever did. So presumably, you know, generally most of those 140,000 people were satisfied with the program, accepted it. So numbers are low, but satisfaction appears to be on the higher end. Now, the problem, of course, is how do we get it so that the numbers will be high enough? Because 140,000, it probably doesn't justify the expenditures comparatively versus if we numbers get up there at a higher level. And again, it doesn't really, in one sense, also address the issue of, you know, is there a problem of people not being given access to free file programs when they are trying to do so or when they are qualified to do so? So again, it is in an intermediate state. That's where we stand right now. Now, the IRS did say no decision has been made at the time it was announced that, hey, we're now done, right? April 15th is over. We're done with this program for this year. Notice has been made regarding the future of the program. And that would include things about, you know, will it be expanded next year? Is it going to be considered a flop and dropped? You know, if it's expanded, does it go nationwide? Will other states, you know, will they be able to get other states to come in and participate in the program so that people could direct file everything? Or is it going to just kind of die off, being there, not go? And can they get the program up and running the same time as e-file itself opens and not get started effectively, you know, a month and a half after they started accepting returns otherwise through the electronic filing system? Now, the IRS did say they're not going to wait a huge amount of time for this answer. An announcement about the future of direct file is expected later this spring. Now, of course, remember, spring runs through June, but that does mean at least within the next month and a half or so, the theory is we should have an announcement about what they're going to do next year. My guess is they will expand the program next year. Nationwide, we'll see. Hopefully, if they're going to do it, they're going to also expand the program to allow it to be started earlier in tax season. Now, obviously, the people that qualify for this program are not generally the clients of the people that listen to this podcast, right? The income requirements and other issues are going to make it less of a problem. And they're also going to be people who would, you know, let's say, presumably otherwise have just gotten an electronic filing program online. So it's there. It does indicate, though, you know, there is pressure on the service and pressure in Congress to try to do more of what other countries do, which is automate this as much as possible and use the, you know, in essence, just have people file returns if they disagree with what the information returns say their tax liability should be. And so don't be surprised if this does become successful or even if it doesn't, and then we run into flaws in this, that you're going to see a lot of people proposing the second. Now, there are a lot of flaws with the second, with this proposal and the way the U.S. has structured things. The main one with this, have them prepare a return and you approve it, is how much time is given for information returns to be filed, in particular brokerages and the number of revised brokerage returns that come in, et cetera. That suggests that, you know, and the time it takes to get in the IRS system, you know, they expect the transcript somewhere, you know, May, June, they'll finally get the transcript information updated. So, yeah, it would certainly push the tax filing date into the future. But obviously, people with Schedule Cs, I suspect K-1s, because I really doubt they're going to ever be able to properly integrate K-1s into the system. Things like that would still have to file. So keep your eyes on these sort of programs. So this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 29th, 2024. Again, current federal tax developments, get that outline right, is brought to you each week, or pretty much each week. We skip usually right around the deadlines because I have things to do and you have things to do. But we'll take a look otherwise as every week. So watch for us next week. We'll talk about whatever comes up there. Also, I do have, you know, try to watch the email address at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Again, it somewhat depends upon whether I have, you know, if I'm in the middle of doing a lot of stuff, sometimes that's going to kind of get delayed. Just be aware of that. I also follow along to a large extent with the discussions on the Connect sites for Arizona, New Jersey. Have also membership in Minnesota, Illinois, Washington, for those, and Idaho has their discussion forum, which is, I guess it is now officially Connect, so it is Idaho on Connect as well. So I do follow those. You remember those state societies, you can post something on their discussion boards, and if I see it and I think I can help, I may respond there as well. Otherwise, we will see you a week from now when we come up with whatever has developed in the following week in the area of current federal tax developments.